Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Mountains have played a major role in the American psyche and the history of our country. Once perceived as places of evil or barriers to progress, the conquest of their peaks became a key component of the westward expansion in the 19th century. Our fascination with mountains and those who climbed them inspired two of America's greatest contributions to the world, the establishment of national parks and the birth of the modern environmental movement. This morning, we talk with Morris Isserman, whose History of American Mountaineering, Continental Divide, A History of American Mountaineering, explores the philosophy, politics, and spirituality that shapes and drives people to climb mountains and the impact that that has on those of us who don't. Morris is a professor of history at Hamilton College in upstate New York and author of numerous books on the history of the American left and more recently on mountaineering. Morris, welcome to Locus Focus.
Hi, Barbara. Nice to be here.
It's good to talk to you again after all these years.
Yeah.
Well,
it's great to it's great to be on KBOO for my very first interview on the official publication day of the book, because I discovered mountains and had a radio show on KBOO at about the same time in the late 60s and early 1970s.
Well, it's good to have you back on KBOO.
I think I'm a better mountaineer than I was a KBOO programmer, because I kept having something the director called dead air.
Well, actually, if you're up for it, we might have you join us in our pitching for the pledge drive, because we're going to be doing
a
few minutes.
Why
so
not?
You can get your old radio chops back.
Yeah.
So I wanted to start, Morris, by asking you why you started writing about mountaineering after all those years about writing all a great, impressive array of books about the American left.
Well, thank you. I think it was a midlife crisis. And I realized that if I hadn't said it by now about the 60s, and about the left and so forth, it probably wasn't something I was going to be able to say very well. And I was casting around with another old Portland friend, Michael Kazin, with whom I'd written a book about the 60s for a new topic. And he reminded me, we used to go climb Mount Hood and Mount St. Helens, and that I was really into it. And why didn't I do a book on that? And so that led to me doing my first book on mountaineering, which was History of Himalayan Mountaineering, called Fallen Giants, which came out in 2008, and one thing led to another, and that led me to Continental Divide, History of American Mountaineering, which, as I said, just is coming out today.
And I'm also curious why you chose the name Continental Divide, because your book really starts out with people climbing mountains in New England, but the Continental Divide seems to be maybe more metaphorical for what you were trying to get across in the book.
It is. The Continental Divide, of course, the Rockies provide the watershed. All the water from one side goes into the Pacific, and all the water from the other side goes eventually into the Atlantic. But the Continental Divide really became a symbol of America after our greatest period of division, after the Civil War. And many people looked at it as a place of healing, of unification, not least represented in the song America the Beautiful, Purple Mountain Majesties. So mountains really became a symbol of our national purpose and our national mission in the second half of the 19th century.
Well, you, like me, grew up in New England, and I just wonder if
Absolutely.
You have a strong recollection of the first time that you saw a real mountain as opposed to those little hills that we had back in New England.
Right. We didn't do mountains in Connecticut. No, the first time I saw a real mountain was actually in a plane descending into Portland in September 68, when I was coming as a freshman at Reed, a place I'd never visited. That seems like the Dark Ages, when people chose colleges without actually going on a campus visit. And there were these big white things, and I thought, how interesting. And it wasn't too long before, thanks to the Reed Outing Club, and then later on my own, I was out exploring those mountains. So this is a book, in a way, is really Oregon-inspired and Cascades-inspired.
Well, actually, I was thinking about the first time that I saw real mountains, because I had the same experience with you. I mean, there are hills in western Massachusetts that they call mountains, and there's a little hill outside of my hometown called Mount Wachusett, which I think is about 1,000 feet high, so kind of comparable to Mount Tabor here in Portland. But I was in Banff, and I was traveling across country doing one of those necessary trips you did in the early 70s from the East Coast to the West Coast, traveling across Canada. And we had been in Calgary and could see the Rockies on the skyline. But at the end of our stay in Calgary, we drove to Banff at night. And the next morning woke up, and one of my friends I was traveling with got me out of bed and walked me to one end of the hostel room that we were staying in and pointed out these amazing peaks and then silently walked me to the other side and of the room. There's another window, more amazing peaks. And it was something that I could not even fathom as I was looking at this because I'd only seen mountains in photographs and in movies. And I wonder what your feeling is when you actually are close in, you know, in these mountains, what it makes you feel when you've grown up basically on the flatlands all your life.
Yeah, we do have a reverence for mountains, but I think it's trained into us in a way. Even those of us who grew up just surrounded by hills, we expect to be inspired by mountains, which certainly wasn't true when Europeans first arrived in the New World. I mean, they saw mountains as places where there were wild animals and wild people and as barriers to expansion westward. Lewis and Clark being perfect examples. They loved being on the plains. As soon as they hit the Rockies, they were miserable. No more buffalo to eat, and it was cold. And they thought if they could have leveled the mountains, that's what they would have done. But within a very few decades, explorers like John C. Fremont in the Wind River Range in Wyoming and in the Sierras were planting flags on top of mountains they didn't even need to climb. They went to summits. Lewis and Clark never went to a summit. And they saw the mountains as this representing American destiny and American greatness. So we're different than our ancestors in that way.
We're talking with Maurice Isserman, who's author of Continental Divide, A History of American Mountaineering. Maurice, you talk about in your book how, I guess, a lot of Europeans and maybe even some indigenous people in North America felt that mountains kind of were possessed by evil spirits. And I wonder what you mean by that and what kind of impact that had on the human relationship to mountains before people like John C. Fremont decided to climb them.
Well, there's an interesting and unexplained divide in attitude towards mountains among Native Americans because there's archaeological evidence that in the West, in the Rockies and the Sierras, Native Americans did go up high, perhaps for religious purposes, perhaps on hunting trips to catch eagles or for other reasons. But in New England and New York, they shunned the mountains. They thought that there were genies or evil spirits. So as far as we know, the first person to climb a mountain in the White Mountains of New Hampshire was Darby Field in 1642, who was a recent English immigrant in the very early days of New England. And he had some Indians who accompanied him, some local Native Americans who accompanied him, but they wouldn't go to the summit. They thought that would bring death or worse. But Darby Field was regarded as eccentric and maybe even insane by the other Puritans who also had no use for mountains.
Well, for someone who's been on a few mountain peaks, what is your feeling when you get to the top of a mountain?
Well, as I say, I think we're now conditioned to feel that we've reached some higher sphere, not just in altitude, but in awareness. We regard mountains, and this is an 18th century inheritance, as something sublime, something the transcendentalists would, like Thoreau and Emerson, would have said it was a way of getting close to God's own handiwork. You could read scripture, but that was mediated through the humans who took it down. But when you were in the mountains, when you were confronted with raw, rough nature, you were reading the work that God had placed on the landscape. So mountains for us, whether or not we're believers in any particular religion, but they seem to represent a kind of spiritual element. And in the United States, it's both spiritual and patriotic because we have these magnificent mountains of our own. The British climbers, they really invented the sport of alpinism in the 19th century, but they had to go to the Alps to find mountains. They weren't the mountains towering tens of thousands of feet in Britain to climb. But when Americans picked up the sport of alpinism, they were climbing their own mountains.
Well, you mentioned it's kind of a spiritual connection to mountains, but it seems that mountains also play a real strong role in a lot of religions. I mean, like Moses went to the mountaintop.
That's true.
And there's the metaphor Martin Luther King talked about going to the mountaintop. So what does that mean when you go to the mountaintop in a spiritual sense?
Well, you can find evidence in the Old and New Testament of mountains playing a good role, but Christ is brought to a mountaintop to be tempted by Satan. And the medieval theologians looked at the set story of the creation in the 7 days, and they said, look, there's nothing mentioned about mountains. So mountains came about maybe by the flood. They're a symbol of man's sinfulness, why we were expelled from Eden. That was the prevalent attitude down until the late 18th century and beginning of the 19th century in Europe and by extension in the United States.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about how mountains are formed. I know your book is more of a history than a natural history, but yeah. You do talk about some of the geological activities that create mountains. And I guess what I'm most interested in is, why are the Rockies so different from the Appalachians?
Well, all those sections, I relied heavily on Hamilton College's geology department to keep me from making any very grave errors. But why are the Rockies different than the what?
The Appalachians.
Because they're much younger. The Appalachians were once Himalayan size when they were created, but they were created hundreds of millions of years earlier, and so they have eroded as the Appalachians are today. So the Rockies will be, after we're all long dead and gone.
What's fascinating to me as I started to get to know mountains, particularly when I spent a lot of time exploring the Rockies about 10, 15 years ago, and there's all these different ranges. I think that we think of the Rockies as this big mountain range that goes from almost the Mexican border up into Canada.
Right.
But in reality, it's many, many ranges. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what ranges comprise the Rockies and how and the distinctions between those.
Well, the Rockies begin in Alaska, as you say, and they run almost all the way down to Mexico. When Lewis and Clark approached the Rockies, they thought they were going to be like the Blue Ridge Mountains that they were familiar with. Both of them were native Virginians, which is to say a single range that was cut by what are called gaps, where even rivers can flow through the mountains. And they were quite surprised when they got to the top of something called Lemmy Pass, to look out in over Idaho and see the Bitterroots, which are a range within the Rockies, and other ranges beyond that. So the Rockies, in places, are 200, 300 miles wide, not a simple matter of just getting over one range. Colorado Rockies are probably the most famous in the United States, and they are your experience at Banff, just coming from the plains, and the earlier explorers would travel for days and days and days on foot and see these mountains looming out of the plains in front of them.
Actually, I was thinking about these different levels of awestruckness that you can be with mountains, and there was my first experience at Banff, which is a pretty awe-inspiring place to be, unless
right.
You're in town itself, which is sort of a disappointing thing these days. But the mountains that you and I are familiar with in the Northwest are pretty much isolated peaks. They're volcanoes that are spaced a bit of distance between them. And the next awe-inspiring experience I had was when I was in the Andes in Venezuela. And I was actually on a bus ride, and we were going through, it was an overnight bus ride, and it was a full moon night, and I couldn't sleep at all. And I look out as we get into the Andes, and there are peaks. I mean, they really dwarf the peaks in Banff. I mean, it was a totally amazing experience. I'm wondering, I'm assuming you've been in some mountains that are as high as that, and sort of, again, talking about the elevational difference between being on a mountain like that and being in the Oregon Cascades.
Well, the thing about the Oregon Cascades is they were known entities even before there were people of European descent coming to Oregon, because they could be spotted from the sea, and because they stood apart, as you say, they're volcanoes, so they are distinct on the landscape. They could be seen easily. There was not so much a sense of discovery involving them. Whereas if you go down into the Sierras, there were huge mountains in the Sierras that nobody knew about until after the Civil War. Similarly, in the Colorado Rockies, to do mountaineering there was an act both of exploration as well as of ascending an individual peak.
I want to talk about some of the stories you tell in your book about some of these explorations. And I guess one of my favorite ones was the discovery and misdiscovery of Mount Whitney, which seemed to happen over and over again.
Right. Right. Well, Whitney is one of those peaks that's kind of tangled up in a whole collection of other mountains and ravines, and merely approaching it was a challenge to the early explorers like Clarence King and others in California, and they kept climbing the wrong mountain. In fact, King went so far as to devote the last chapter of his book, Mountaineering in the Sierra, which came out in 1867, to this triumphant account of how he made the first descent on what was called Mount Whitney after another earlier explorer. And then someone else discovered that he had climbed the wrong mountain and kind of gleefully revealed that this famous explorer didn't know what he was talking about or where he was.
We're talking with Maurice Isserman, who's author of Continental Divide, A History of American Mountaineering. There's been a lot of discussions over the years that I've followed, especially since I started living close to mountains and knowing a lot of people who climb them, about the kind of environmental ethics of climbing. And I guess one of the points that your book has been a little controversial about was you basically see the glory days of mountaineering as ending in 1963. And at that point, this is at least what I gleaned from your book, it became a lot more of a popular sport. And the kind of rarefied brotherhood of the rope, as you call it, and the sense of community that climbers had was dissipated because so many people were climbing. So that's one conflict right there. But another one that I recall from my friends who climbed and the little climbing that I've done myself is the ethics of like kind of the leave no trace versus let's make a wall of pitons to climb up and let anybody access it. So I wanted to talk about both of these conflicts in the remaining time that we have. First, I wanted to talk about why do you feel that the glory days of mountaineering ended in 1963?
I don't think I said that exactly.
You were misinterpreted in the New York Times, let's say that way. But what was your point about what the change after 63?
I think after 63, first of all, that's a moment I come in as a climber myself. And for the very first time, climbing is a mass participation sport. Before that, it had been seen as a kind of an eccentric thing to do. I mean, there were devoted mountaineers. There were clubs like the Mazamas and the Sierra Club, and the Appalachian Mountain Club. But it was a pretty elite activity. It was a pretty WASPy activity, and it was only found in a few odd corners of the country and society. And by the late 1960s. You know, the number of people climbing on Mount Hood jumps from a few hundred a year to thousands every year, so much so that eventually they had to introduce a permit system, which wasn't the case when I was first going to Mount Hood. You just decided you wanted to climb Mount Hood, and you drove off in the evening to Timberline Lodge. Climbing goes through a transition. There's been wonderful climbing done in the Northwest and Yosemite since, and climbing techniques have been enhanced. But it's not the world it once was. It once was climbers knew each other. They knew of each other. They had mentors. There were well-known East Coast mountaineers who came out to California to teach this rope craft. And that was kind of replaced. Climbing became divided into different forms of climbing, ice climbing and sport climbing and gym climbing and rock climbing, and people wouldn't cross paths so much. So for me, it was a less coherent story than it had been up to that point. I do talk about the later developments, but more in an epilogue than devoting an entire chapter to them.
Well, another thing that I thought about as I was reading your book is how climbing became, became more of a mass activity. It also changed from, particularly climbing in the Himalayas, it changed from being something that you needed skill to do to something that you just needed money. And I think that John Krakauer's book, Into Thin Air, is a great example of the pitfalls of that.
Yeah, that's certainly true in terms of Mount Everest, where commercial guided climbing arose in the late 80s, and of course still defines climbing, on at least on the south side of the mountain, to this day. There had been guided climbing before in the Alps. No British alpinist would climb without a French or Italian guide, but the alpinists themselves were as skilled as their guides were, but infamously into thin air, people who basically didn't belong on the mountain were being led up on ropes. It's all, you just click your jumar onto a fixed rope and you walk up the mountain. It's not real mountaineering, and it creates the possibility of great tragedy because there's too many people on the mountain, and it, the tragedies have come along regularly since, sweeping up both the clients, Sherpas, and guides alike.
Well, you actually describe one of those tragedies. There's a case of somebody who had basically bankrolled a climb, and so one of the climbers felt obligated to bring this person along. Why don't you talk a little bit about what happened in that case?
Well, that was a much earlier example, the 1939 American expedition to K2, where Fritz Wiesner, who was a very skilled climber and probably the greatest climber of his era in the United States, nonetheless, on a poorly funded expedition, invited along a kind of amateur climber who was actually better as a skier than a climber, named Dudley Wolf. And Wolf climbed high on the mountain, but then basically got marooned at a high camp and couldn't get down it. So he was the first American, not the last, to die on K2. And his role was really to bankroll the expedition more than to be a contributing climber. But it would be many more years after that before you saw the rise of real commercial climbing concentrated on Everest.
Well, another issue that you sort of touch on the book, but actually not enough to my satisfaction in a way, because this is something that I've been really fascinated by, is the divide over hardware. And that you describe these people setting up these climbs in Yosemite back, probably in the 40s and the 50s, where they would use expansion bolts and pitons, and they would just leave them in there. And I remember when I started doing rock climbing in the in the late 70s, there was already, we would have discussions with the people that were training me about not leaving hardware behind, that in fact it's a real desecration of these sacred areas that we're climbing in. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the different viewpoints and where you think that debate has kind of leveled off in the recent years.
Right. Well, the use of pitons for protection and for direct aid began in the Eastern Alps. Italian and Austrian climbers in the early 20th century developed the techniques, which very slowly spread across the Atlantic. American climbers were most took their climbing ethics from the English alpinists, and the English alpinists were very conservative and traditional, and they saw the use of pitons as cheating. But starting in the 1930s, the rock climbing section of the Sierra Club in San Francisco and Los Angeles began ordering their piton. You couldn't get them in the United States. They began ordering them from a Munich sporting goods store, discovered that they could climb at a much higher level. They could take a much greater level of risk. At first, using the pitons with carabiners clipped into them and ropes run through it only for protection. So if they fell, they'd only fall a little further than their highest piton rather than all the way down to the ground. But they began using them, particularly in the 1950s, in the golden age of Yosemite climbing, as it's called, in direct aid to get up sheer granite faces with tiny cracks or no cracks at all that otherwise they could not have climbed. But it was some of those very same Yosemite climbers like Royal Robbins and Yvon Chouinard who in the late 60s and 1970s began promoting what was, when I was beginning to climb, the notion of clean climbing. So you wouldn't leave behind a trail of expansion bolts, and you wouldn't be hammering pitons, which can damage the rock, into cracks. Rather, you'd use chocks, nuts, other devices, which were removable and didn't leave as much damage So there was a continuing debate about that, and then those debates go on in new form today between sports climbers who want to fix a route with fixed bolts so they can climb gracefully and quickly and athletically up a route, and those who are more traditional trad climbers who think that's a desecration. Climbing is always evolving, and there are always these kind of debates over ethics.
Well, what's your take on that?
My take on it is I haven't climbed at that level for many years, so I have the greatest affection for the period when I began climbing, which was the clean climbing era. But I would not be judgmental of those who have other ideas today.
Well, there was somebody who was pitching to get on the show a couple years ago who I didn't actually have that much interest in having him on, and I can't remember the name of this peak. It's down near Patagonia, southern Chile or Argentina, and it's this basically sheer wall that's very, very, very tall. And this guy has put a bunch of bolts up so you can climb to the top. And
Right. My
sense when I read about it, and I guess it's kind of a controversial route, but I was sort of appalled by that. And I do wonder what you think about taking a face, an amazing rock face, and making it into a climbing surface.
Yeah. On the other hand, you know, there are people today who achieve levels of proficiency on rock by using that kind of direct aid and that were unimaginable before. I think this debate is going to be with us forever. And there are people who climb routes and chop bolts. They you know, cut out the bolts that other climbers have put there, but of course that also leaves the rock scarred.
Because I remember when I was first learning to climb at Horse Thief Rocks in the Columbia Gorge, and we would occasionally come across pitons, and my trainer was very appalled by that stuff. So I guess she was from the clean school, too. And it might have sort of set my sense. But also, Horse Thief Rocks is a place where people learn how to climb. It's just completely, it's not quite as used as Indian Rock in Berkeley, but it's certainly a very heavily used place, and you can feel the impact of all that climbing. So it seems that leaving pitons in place only exacerbates that kind of overuse feeling.
Right. Well, it's one of the problems of climbing becoming a mass participation sport. We have an ease of access to these places, and more people know how to do the sport, so there's going to be more damage. Until the end of the 19th century, until 1915, there wasn't a road leading into Yosemite Valley, which helped preserve the valley. But, whereas in John Muir's time, you'd have a few thousand people visiting Yosemite Valley in a summer, and he worried about that. Today, you'll have 2 million people in the warm season visiting the valley, and then it becomes a traffic jam.
Well, even on Mount Hood, when I first moved to Mount Hood, well, the south part of the mountain was very accessible. The north face along Lolo Pass Road was like a riverbed, and now it's paved except for about 12 miles of it. So even there, like the north face of Mount Hood is much more accessible, and you can see the difference.
Right. Well, it was always better when we were young.
Of course.
One thing you can rely on.
Okay. Well, it's really great to talk with you, Morris, and thanks very much for writing this book.
And thank you for inviting me on KBOO.
Well, thanks a whole lot for joining us.
Okay.
And we've been talking with Morris Isserman today, who's author of Continental Divide, A History of American Mountaineering. And next week, we'll be talking with Bob Yates, who's author of Earthquake Time Bombs. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your family, your friends to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by the band. Thanks for listening, and become a member of KBOO.